from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this special 4th of July edition of Forum, we'll bring you two more interviews from our archives. First, New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast watched her elderly parents start down the slippery slope of dementia. She chronicled her roller coaster ride of emotions and the tough life decisions she had to make for her parents in her graphic memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Then at 10:30, bilingual poetry from San Francisco's own poet laureate, Alejandro Murguia. He'll talk with us about San Francisco's Latino history and the city's changing landscape, and we'll hear his poetry. That's coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. And we're joined this hour by veteran New Yorker cartoonist and author Roz Chast, the only child of Brooklyn-based public educator parents. She recently published a graphic memoir called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It's all about caregiving for her elderly parents as they aged and became increasingly enfeebled. And she joins us for this morning's second hour. I'm delighted to have you here. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, where to begin? One of the biggest impressions I came away with after reading your book was we're kind of sold a bill of goods about the golden years. You can't help realizing, because of your honesty and because of the way you uncover what you went through, and some of it's funny, of course, because it has your wit to it, but just how difficult this experience of caregiving can be. Your parents lived into their 90s, and they just kept going downhill.
Yeah, it's not something that people talk about too much. I think that people probably call it the golden years because if they didn't talk about it at all, it would be a sort of glaring omission. And so they make up this thing about the golden years. And I think most people do know it's kind of a crock.
It's also a tremendous onus, which with your wit and your cleverness, you also make abundantly clear. That is, the expense, the burden, the guilt, the denial, all of that, and the dependency. I mean, suddenly you've got really parents who you were dependent on who are dependent on you.
That's true. And to some extent, I think it was ever thus. But there's also this added factor, which is, you know, something I think about the age in which we live, which is that in the past, I think people got to a certain age and for the most part, they got to that age and they got sick and they got weaker and they died. And I'm not advocating that, you know, saying that this would be a great thing for everybody to die at 65, but that now with modern medical science, it's sort of possible to prolong life for a lot of people way past when they even want to be alive.
All this new technology.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have resilient spirits like your mother who are pretty much ready to write her off. And then suddenly you come in one day and there she is with her shoes and eating a tuna fish sandwich. And you say, where's the tuna fish sandwich? And it's Kubler-Ross stuff. Eating a tuna fish sandwich.
Yeah.
I also want to... Well, there's so much to touch upon, but you were really trying to be a good daughter, and you were feeling that sense of I wasn't a great caretaker, great as a caretaker. At one point, you say they weren't great in being taken care of, but with all due deference, you were taking care of them, and you were stepping up to the plate. And I know that you went through all this ambivalence, but at the same time, whether you realize it or not, you're kind of a model for people who may not be able to take it and stand up to it.
I don't feel that way. I mean, I feel like, I don't think that there are a lot of great options out there. And that was something that I don't think I really knew until I had to face it, that the options were either running away from it and, you know, letting the chips fall where they may, you know, just not dealing with my parents' increasing, you know, enfeeblement and my father leaving the stove on and my mother falling and just saying, you know what, I wash my hands of all this and I'm an only child, but like, you know, I'm just out of here. That's not a good option. And I don't think emotionally I was capable of that option. Then there was the hiring full-time, round-the-clock care for them in enabling them to stay in their apartment, but hiring. They did not want that. It was a small apartment. They did not want a stranger living in there with them. And I didn't feel that was a good option because I was living two and a half hours away, and that would have made me very anxious, you know, just what is going on there and is this person trustworthy and what happens if that person gets sick and then the agency sends over another person that, you know, my parents don't even know, and that was sort of spooky. And so the option of taking – finally taking them out of their apartment and putting them in the book I call it The Place, which was an assisted living place about 10 minutes from me, that was
– In Connecticut.
Yeah. It was not great, but it was the best – option of all the not good options.
The least of evils, as
yeah.
the old cliche would have it.
Yeah.
And it's also going back to Brooklyn. I mean, you really give us a kind of multidimensional and nuanced view of your parents and who they were. And I couldn't help but thinking, particularly since you put them under the spotlight and talk about their idiosyncrasies and some of their difficulties, although I think the love shines through ultimately. But I wonder how they would have responded in their prime to this kind of portrait.
I think my father might have understood it. I'm not so sure about my mother.
Your mother was one tough lady, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was very, very tough. I think there's a lot of things here. I mean, it was her upbringing, but there's also the generational difference. And I've been thinking about this more, and I was thinking, you know, when she – my parents were both born in 1912, and that's a whole other thing from a baby boomer, which I am, and
– But they had you late.
They had me very late.
And they also lost a child before
yes.
you were born, so there
yes.
was very difficult in many ways and extenuating kinds of circumstances.
Yes, and they did have very hard lives. They both grew up very poor. They graduated from college into the Depression, and I think that they saw the kind of anything that was very introspective or complaining or talking about, you know, depression or anything like that. My mother particularly saw it as belly aching or navel gazing or just something sort of stupid and weak and selfish, and that you just didn't. You just didn't go around saying, I feel sad because of it. It was like, you know, shut up. You have food in the house. You have a roof over your head. You don't know what trouble is. You know, you're just, you know, buck up.
I know what trouble was, though. When your mother got angry, that was trouble. A blast from chest.
Yes.
In fact, there's a moment in the book. I couldn't help kind of relishing this moment in a way. Forgive me. But your father's trying to get a key in a door, and he's going, oh, my God. And you go bats.
Yeah.
You become your mother in a sense.
Oh, absolutely. I completely lost it. I mean, that was when my mother was in the hospital, and my father came to live with us because he could not be left alone in the apartment. He was much more senile than I thought, and he really could not be left alone. And so he came to live with us in Connecticut, and we would go into Brooklyn almost every day to see my mother in the hospital. And he was so obsessed with the idea that somebody was going to break into the apartment and steal the bank books, many of which were from banks that had, you know, gone out of business like 20 years before. But it gave him such comfort to know that he had looked at them. And why didn't he take them with? I don't really even remember why. It was just like they had to stay where they were, which was in some file cabinet or something. And maybe it was just he needed to check on the apartment also and to make sure it was still there and it was a way for him to center himself. Anyway, so one time I brought him there and it was just – this whole thing was exhausting and, you know, I was at the end of my rope. And the key was very glitchy because it was an old apartment. And he couldn't get the key to turn in the lock. Oh, and I would be the one to be, like, turning it. And it wasn't turning. And he started freaking out in the hallway.
Oh, my God.
You know, the key's going to break off in the lock. He just, like, got into a panic. And I just started screaming at him, and like I swore at him in the hallway because I was just at the end of my rope, and it was like, oh my God, I can't believe I did this. I had like my poor senile father, and I like just told him, I'm not even going to say it because we're on the radio, but like I used language to just tell him that I was going to freak the something out if he didn't like pull it together.
talking again with Roz Shast, and her new book is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant. You give us, as I say, a full and nuanced portrait of your parents, a multidimensional portrait, but also of yourself. And you were saying your mother didn't like you to say poor me or any of that sort of thing. But what comes across is a portrait of a young kind of, well, girl who went through a difficult childhood, who was shy, maybe even hostile and paranoid. You've used those words before, maybe even ADD. I mean, it was a troubling childhood.
Yeah, I was not a happy camper, as they say. No, I really, I have no nostalgia for childhood or Brooklyn.
And, but yet when you went back to Brooklyn, you were kind of dragooned into almost, they said, you know, you, it's not that you can't go home again. Thomas Wolfe also said, only the dead know Brooklyn. But you, in effect, found this Brooklyn of your youth and found that it just didn't fit into your life when you had your own kids, your own family.
No, it didn't. In fact, we lived in Park Slope briefly, my husband and I. We lived in on the Upper West Side, Manhattan, for a long time. And before my son was born in 1987, we moved to Park Slope. But Park Slope is really different from the part of Brooklyn that I was from. I mean,
it's now a haven for young people.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, there were young people. Even when in 87, there were lots of young people, families there. The part of Brooklyn that I was from was really, it was kind of off the map. It was the kind of place where if Dunkin' Donuts opened up a store, which it did, it was a cause for celebration because it was like, oh my God, corporate America realizes that there are people here who have enough money to buy a donut at Dunkin' Donuts. That's like really a step up.
Well, when you mentioned Dunkin' Donuts, I was charmed and I must say entertained by some of the names you give some of these places, like these homes, End of Trail Acres, Final Bridge, the Sunset Gardens, all these kind of parodying all the euphemisms until you get to the last stop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, there these places do have these names that there was actually the New Yorker when they ran that excerpt, they fact checked that, and there was a Sunset Gardens retirement community someplace, but it was in another part of the country, so they let it go. But I mean, who names these places? It's terrible. It's just like it's my parody was just like one step away from the real thing.
Well, you write about things that are very difficult to write about, and again, I give you kudos for that. And I'm thinking about there's a scene in a book called Patrimony by Philip Roth, which you might know, where it's a scatological scene where his father loses control and becomes incontinent, and this is exactly what happens with your mother. And this, for Roth, becomes a real test of his love as a child, because somehow, of course, one's dignity is obviously lost in that kind of circumstance, and for you, it was a moment of truth, wasn't it?
It was, truth in that we know that the body fails, you know. And I think my mother was very humiliated, but I wanted to let her know that I know what the body is. I mean, it's horrible. It is horrible, but it's not, it's shocking in one way, but it's so unsurprising in another way. It's like this is, I mean, it was shocking when it happened, but actually it's not. It's like, this is what happens. This is what happens when people are extremely old. And it may happen to you. It may very well happen to me. It's like, this is what happens. And I think sometimes when I see these ads for some product for seniors on TV, like Centrum Silver or Depends or something, and the people in the ads are these sort of spry, you know, for all I know, they're like 55-year-olds that have been made up to look older, you know. They're really not, it's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about way, way past that.
And when you encounter actually the narrative and the story that you provide for us here, you realize that that you have to face death and you have to face your own mortality too, because there's nobody left ahead of you. And you did something, you did a lot of unusual things in this. You used real photographs, you used your mother's doggerel poetry. But at the end, it seems like you're compelled to want to draw your mother when she's really literally on her deathbed. And I was thinking, of course, of the photographs that Annie Leibovitz took of Susan Sontag. It reminded me of that, and because there was a lot of criticism of that, you know. But you were doing what you, I think, wanted to do in terms of making us look at the reality of what you were up against.
Yeah, and it was a way to spend time with my mother that wasn't just sitting and, like, looking. It was sitting and looking and drawing, which is what I do. It's what I've always done. It's what I've done since I was a child. It's what I do.
And it's still, for you, a way of removing yourself from trouble?
Yeah, I think so.
Or anxiety?
I think so, yeah.
Are you still afraid of balloons, by the way?
Yeah, I am. I am. I hate balloons.
I just was curious about
that.
Yeah, yeah. And your mother, toward the end, had these surreal, you call them surreal dreams, which you cataloged and brought to our attention. And
yeah.
They're really quite something.
They're kind of funny and weird.
But people in their senility or their senescence, whatever you want to call it, they do come up with these evocative landscapes of imaginative narratives that you never even expected.
Oh, it was fascinating. And some of them, a lot of them, I could really see root of them, like what was causing them. Like, she wanted to be able to give me an apartment in New York. She knew how much I missed living in New York and that it was probably never going to happen because, you know, it turns out that, you know, neither my husband nor I are, like, you know, tech magnates or, you know, any of that. We're or, you know, Brazilian heiresses or anything. It's just it happens to be the case. And so she would have these strange, you know, I'd come in and we'd be talking, you know, about my kids and everything would be great. And it would be like this rational conversation. And then she'd tell me about some apartment that my mother had been an assistant principal. And so when I grew up, I would always hear about the Board of Ed. So she would say, the Board of Education owns an apartment that they gave me, and I'm going to give you this apartment. And I'd be like, Mom, well, where is this apartment? It's 550 Park Avenue. You know, there was another one where my grandfather, Harry, who had died when I was three, it turned out he had stacks of $10,000 bills hidden, and I should go looking for them.
This is kind of like Nebraska. You know, she's wanted to give something to
She wanted to give something to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's very touching.
Yes.
And what's also touching is that you wanted to make that connection with your mother. You wanted to have the kind of mother-daughter talk that you long for and yearn for, and just never happened.
It did not happen. It did not happen. And, it's not like a movie. It's not like, you know, a TV movie or something where at the end you have a breakthrough and you have this talk and it's meaningful and it's great. And, you know, then the music comes up and then you find out who played, like, the nurse because she looked familiar, you know, the credits. And no, it didn't happen like that.
Would you suggest then, would maybe the wisdom here be to suggest that people who want to have those talks should have them earlier rather than later?
Yeah, probably. Probably I should have tried to have it earlier.
That's one of the lessons there.
Yeah.
One of the more, I think, moving moments is when you go to that apartment. Your parents are going downhill, clearly. And they were orderly people, for the most part, cleanly people. And suddenly there's grime everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. They really, I think at a certain point, and I've talked to other people who knew exactly what I was talking about with the grime. It's you just give up cleaning in the way that you used to and keeping on top of things. And, you know, the junk mail piles up and it's not dealt with in the newspapers and the magazines and the disorder and the grime, the kind of the coating that's on everything. And it's disturbing. I feel like one of the things about doing this book and being with my parents in these last years of their life was realizing and thinking about my own mortality and realizing that we're all in the same boat and we all always have been. I don't know if that's...
Well, in your book, you talk about it was too bad we don't have opium pipes. I don't think you're saying this with that necessarily to be funny. It's
I was not being facetious when I think about the end. I don't think I want to live forever on Ensure or any of those things or the medical interventions. My mother, at the end, when she was 96 and in very frail and very poor health, the doctor suggested that she have a colostomy. And it just seemed insane. It was, you know.
She even called her sister, and her sister.
Her sister thought maybe it was a good idea. But.
Who gets surgery at that age, though? I
mean. Yeah, she was so frail, and I don't know. I think that it's good to have friends in the church connections, and for me, especially friends.
This is a listener named Mara who writes, I want to thank Ross Chass for being so incredibly honest about the realities of taking care of elderly parents. I'm living through this right now with two parents in their mid-90s, and it is brutal to experience them declining from highly independent people to people who are in real need of guidance and help but resist it mightily but can no longer function well. Ms. Chass has so vividly described the wide range of emotions I experience on a daily basis, extreme sadness, anger, resentment, helplessness, and then gratitude when I'm able to help and they accept the help. We are now at the point of having to decide whether it will be better for them to live apart, given my mother's increasing dementia and my father's own cognitive issues. They've been together 64 years, so this will be a profound change that might be the final blow to their dignity. They are in a wonderful retirement facility thanks to being good savers all their lives, but there has to be a better way to end a life with dignity when there is no quality of life or desire of the person to continue living.
I totally agree with everything that person just said. There's got to be is there a better way? I don't know, but I feel like there's got to be.
It's also the sadness of realizing and trying to make your parents understand that all they'd saved for these years was just going to their caretaking.
Yeah, you have to look at it like a black comedy. I mean, it would not have mattered if my mother had bought herself a cashmere sweater every day of her life. It would not have mattered at all. You know, all of the saving, all of the patched oven mitts. You know, but on the other hand, I was really glad that they had saved because, you know, I don't know what happens when you don't have any money. And then I guess the government, well, first they take away your house. I do know that that happens, because until the government isn't going to take over until they take everything. But I mean, I've heard even worse stories of places than the place that my parents were in. I mean, my parents, as I say in the book, I lay it out pretty clearly what the costs were. But
well, you sure do. You itemize it.
Yeah, I itemize it. I, you know, I think you know we should know this, and I don't mean to be gross about it. It's just that people should know. But recently, I found out about somebody who was telling me that she put her parents or her parents. Voluntarily went to a place. They were in their 80s. And to just go to this place, it cost them $450,000. Huh. And it's a long-term, it's like buying long-term insurance, kind of. But to go to the place, and then on top of that, they had to pay rent. But if her parents, who were in their mid-80s, died like 2 years later, that place would still keep all of that money. It's really bizarre. I mean, they know how to structure this thing for like maximum like getting of money.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum from our archives. Our guest was New Yorker cartoonist Ross Chast. She documented the decline of her elderly parents and some of the painful decisions they had to make together in her graphic memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Stay with us for another program from our archives this 4th of July.